switch the tape on.
Okay, so this logo that I'm sure Ian Bourne designed, who's another artist filmmaker who still lives down the road, I think. It's a big white T-shirt that was designed for the campaign against the final public inquiry, which I think is 89, but I might be wrong. And it's got a rectangular box. It's black on white. It's got a rectangular box printed on the front with a thin black line. And inside there's an image of a house, and there's a lorry driving right through the middle of the house. So the house is sort of smashed in two with all these jagged lines. And then there's a big black exhaust fume coming from the back of the lorry. And to the left of that, it says, "No M11 Link Road campaign." And then underneath that box, it says, "Homes, not roads," printed. And it's all printed in very simple font. Don't know what the name of it would be, but it's a totally simple font. So I've kept that T-shirt ever since, and I'm never throwing it away because it's a historic T-shirt.
So when did you first get involved in the campaign and the public inquiry?
Well, early on, in fact, I think, you know that period of time that I've remembered, you know the, what?
I've done it again. You just, sorry, Sheila, just describe that T-shirt again. But if you can describe it and stay with the mic.
Yes, because I turned away.
Yeah. So maybe you just want to lie it here. I can't believe I keep doing this.
Do you know, I saw you and I thought, did she press both buttons? She knows what she's doing.
I don't. Okay. Right, start with the description.
Now?
Yeah.
Okay, so I've got this T-shirt here, which was made for the campaign against the final public inquiry. And it was designed, I'm pretty sure it was designed by Ian Bourne, who is another artist filmmaker who lived on Grove Green Road and possibly still does, actually. And it's very simple. It's black on white, and there's a black rectangular box printed on the front of the T-shirt, about sort of 10 inches by 4, something like that. And on the right of that box inside, there's a house that's been smashed in two by a lorry that's driving through the middle of it. And there's all these jagged lines where the house has been smashed in two. And behind it, coming from the lorry, there's a big sort of billowing black exhaust fume. And then on the left inside that box, it says, "No M11 Link Road campaign." And then underneath the box on the T-shirt, it says, "Homes, not roads," which was the sort of slogan that we used at the time. And I think the first time I got involved in the campaign was, it was when I was living in Claremont Road, in 18 Claremont Road. So that would put it in at 1989, actually, or possibly even 88. And there was a meeting, I went along to a meeting. And I think it was probably Nick, who I mentioned, who lived in that house, who was involved in the environmental issues. Possibly I heard about it through him. But I went along to this meeting, which was organised by Councillor Evie Edsworthy, who I'd first got to know or known through the Art East Gallery, because we invited all the local officials along to the gallery. And I remember speaking to her then. And she set up this meeting to get local residents involved in, well, to see if local residents wanted to set up a campaign at all. So what happened was they let it be known that there was going to be this meeting. And I think it was in one of the church halls, maybe on Grove Green Road or maybe even over on Lister Road in Leytonstone. One or the other anyway. And Evie Edsworthy and possibly one other councillor said this campaign, this public inquiry will be happening, and the date was set, and basically said, it's over to you, you know, if you, the residents, want to represent yourselves or campaign or anything. We just wanted to get people together in case I think she sort of quietly wanted to set something off but not be involved really, because she was in a difficult position maybe. I don't know. So anyway, from that meeting, I remember meeting people like, at that meeting there was, well, the two people I definitely remember are John Ellis and Elaine McIntyre. And myself and Pete were there. And I remember, and John Ellis and Elaine lived on Colville Road, and he was a musician and she was doing various work, I suppose. But and I can't remember exactly who else was at that meeting, but that was the first meeting. And then got involved in going to other meetings after that and trying to get an idea of how to campaign and what the public inquiry would be like. And there were other people at that meeting. I think there was a guy, there were people who were from maybe more like Hackney Wick or Homerton who were going to be affected as well. One or two people who I vaguely remember. And we started getting our campaign together, which involved, I remember me and Pete going up and down the roads, knocking on doors and asking people if they, you know, what they thought about the road coming through and did they have objections. And I remember particularly knocking on doors on Madeira Road, which is one of the roads that comes off Dyers Hall Road. It runs between Dyers Hall Road and Grove Green Road. And I remember finding an old couple who had a lot to say about it, actually, because he had angina and medical opinion, you know, his doctors had told him it would be really good if he could move out away from the pollution of this area. But their house was outside the scope of, right, blight. If you could prove that they couldn't sell their house because of the imminent construction of the road, yet they couldn't be compulsory purchased or be given a market because they were outside the area of exclusion for proving for being blighted, which at that time at least was only 50 metres from the crown of the road. They were just outside that measurement, so they were stuck basically. And I remember lengthy conversations with them and trying to write a submission for them for the public inquiry, which I put in writing, but you know, I didn't have a computer or anything and it was very messily written and I felt I hadn't really done them justice, but you know, that tried to help them. And so there were more and more meetings and we fundraised for the campaign as well, which meant doing jumble sales and things on a Saturday. So there was a lot of fun as well, but it was all very serious. And you know, people like, you know, Sally Barker and Paul Noble got very involved at that stage as well, as did a lot of other people. But and at that stage we were getting to know people who lived in the area who weren't artists, you know, for the almost the first time getting to know people who had nothing to do with art or ACME in the area. You know, there were a few other people that we got to know who were involved as well, what's the name of other people who lived in houses up and down the roads who were similarly affected to us. I've forgotten the guy's name. There's a guy who lived on Colville Road. Richard Layton. Yeah, Richard Layton. Richard Layton, who lived actually next door to Sharon Hall and David Ryan on Colville Road, and who lived there with his mother, who had lived in that house, I think, all her life or most of her life, and was very elderly and, you know, traumatised by, you know, really would be traumatised by having to move out. So, you know, and then Dolly on Claremont Road. I don't actually remember her personally, but, you know, there were people like that who the campaign got to know who really were going to be seriously affected by the road.
So did someone like Dolly, did she turn up to these meetings?
No, I don't think Dolly ever came along to the meetings. I remember first hearing about Dolly when I lived on Claremont Road because Nick used to help her with something or other, so he would talk about her, and this is before the campaign kicked off, so I'd heard about her then. And then obviously she became, you know, as the campaign went on, she became more well known actually, because people sort of, well, she was obviously someone who was going to be majorly affected and who the campaign was sort of acting for actually, you know, someone who'd been in their house all their life and, you know, it was a big trauma to for this to be happening to them. Much more vulnerable than anyone who was younger, I think.
Can you remember any other local people?
Well, Elaine, Sheila and Elaine on Colville Road, who I can't remember. I mean, I just remember them because I knew people on Colville Road. I had a particularly good friend, Sandra Smith, who lived on Colville Road, who knew them. And then there were other people I knew on Colville Road. And I just sort of knew that community. And, you know, if you walked up and down Colville Road, their kids would be out playing in the street and you'd hear them. You know, you'd hear those voices yelling for their kids, which are recorded on, I think, John Smith's film Blight. He's got them on the soundtrack of that film. It's all very evocative of that time, really moving whenever I hear that. Who else do I remember? Oh, and actually Sheila's eldest daughter, Karina, moved into our house on Claremont Road briefly for a while, which makes me think maybe I was there for 2 years rather than one. Anyway, but when Rachel went to Spain, to live in Spain temporarily, to teach English and see a bit of Spain, Karina moved in for a few months or up to a year at least. She was about 18.
Because he was there for quite a long time, up to 1997.
Yeah.
On Grove Green Road. Do you know what happened to those people?
I know Sheila is still living around here because I catch sight of her sometimes. She lives somewhere not so far from here, so the other side of Leighton Tube Station from Claremont and Colville Road. I don't know what's happened to Lorraine. I know that, well, John Ellis and Elaine McIntyre, who were involved in the campaign, they still live around here. Richard Layton, I believe, moved out to somewhere further along the Central Line, and occasionally I hear that someone's seen him, but I don't really know what's happened to him. What happened to Dolly? Didn't she? I don't think she's still alive. I'm sure she moved into and got some supported accommodation, but it can't have been good for her. Richard's mother died, and I can't remember exactly when, but it was awful, I think, when Richard had to move out of his house. I think that was terrible. I can't remember the whole detail. I think it was traumatic for her, as it was for Elaine McIntyre and John Ellis, because they had a new baby when they had to move out of their house.
So you've talked about leafleting for the campaign.
And knocking on doors and talking to people face to face.
You attended the public inquiries, didn't
you?
Could you talk about that?
Oh, blimey. Well, yeah, the public inquiry, the final public inquiry, which happened in the town hall in Stratford. Basically, we'd had quite a lot of contact with people who had campaigned against roads in other areas. There were people who were from Archway and other parts of London. And so we'd had advice from people. And then there was another person, I think he lived over in Hackney Wick, who had done a... who was making a presentation at the public inquiry to campaign against the exchange land, you know, making out that the road was going to take all this beautiful grass verges and land where daffodils grew in the spring in profusion, and, you know, what they were going to give us back wasn't worth losing that, you know, it wasn't a fair exchange. So the campaign kind of had a lot of people in it. Not everybody was local. There was a guy who was a toxicologist who got involved. Can't remember his name. People who had experience of campaigning. And then there was all of us. A lot of different people who lived up and down the road. And probably before the public inquiry started, I remember doing a stopping the traffic protest up in Leytonstone, which I think John Ellis was the press secretary for the campaign because he had a good mind for that. And he set up this protest one morning where we all dressed up in those white paper suits that people wear to keep themselves away from, you know, if there's a crime scene or something, people get dressed up in these full-length white suits that cover your head. And then we had breathe masks on so that we weren't breathing in the pollution, and we just walked backwards and forwards over the zebra crossing up in Leytonstone and stopped the traffic for half an hour or something. Probably made us very unpopular with certain people, but we were carrying placards and trying to get a point across. So that was a sort of precursor to the public inquiry. We were trying to get the message into the local press, and I suppose probably national press if they'd been interested at that stage. And then the public inquiry started, and it was very formal. It was like, you know, being in the courtroom, really. It's set up with that sort of form. And I think one of our tactics was to try and stall it as much as possible. So there was quite a lot of barracking, and also people trying to campaign, trying to present their evidence. And a lot of things were ruled to be outside the scope of the inquiry because it was only about exchange land issues. They wouldn't listen to anything else. And it was a very intense time. It was very intense. You know, it was kind of, I think we were all, well, speaking for myself, I think I'm glad that I had that experience, but it was a bit traumatic as well. It's quite hard actually trying to take on something like that. And I think if I was doing it again, I would try to do it in a slightly more skilled way. But at the same time, we were doing what we thought was right. And a lot of us did get thrown out one afternoon because we were barracking. I'm a bit embarrassed about that now, but at the same time, it seemed like the right thing to do. You know, I don't think it's necessarily a good way to get your point across, but sometimes you do have to protest about things. I'd rather be polite, you know, and do things that way, but it seemed appropriate at the time. And particularly as, well, it did just seem wrong to be knocking down a couple of hundred houses. And for the people that we knew of who were, you know, people who had, for instance, lived in their houses for a long, long time and maybe been born there, like Richard Layton's mum and Richard Layton himself. Oh, and also there were people like, on Dyers Hall Road, there was a family who lived next door to Pete and me in 103 Dyers Hall Road. So they must have been 105, actually. And we never knew them. Pete just had a sort of a nodding hello kind of relationship with them. But they were a family who must have lived there for a long time. They certainly weren't Acme tenants or anything. They moved out at a certain point. They got moved on. But, you know, there were a few families around, I think, who'd been there for a long, long time. So the public inquiry was very intense. And I did things like, I had a part-time admin job in a housing association at that stage, and I know that I took a large amount of my annual leave entitlement from that job in order to attend the public inquiry. So there was a level of commitment there, you know, from a lot of people, including me.
So you mentioned the final public inquiry.
Which was that inquiry?
What year?
Well, so hard to remember. Maybe 1990, maybe 91, maybe 92, I don't know.
Okay, did you go to other public
inquiries? No. All the other public inquiries had happened before that, you know, before we even moved in 1985, as far as I know. In fact, I think I do know that for sure. Public inquiries happened before that to actually decide the line of the road. That had been decided probably decades before. So this was just the final public inquiry, which was only about exchange land issues.
Okay.
Which is to do with, there was some of the land that was taken for the road was common land, for instance, down at Hackney Wick, Hackney Marshes, probably other bits as well along the route of the road. And in law, if they were taking that land for to build a road, they had to give back land to the same, I think, the same sort of geographical area. So it was to do with the camp, the issue was to do with whether the land they were offering back was good enough, you know, and it was said, it was, you know, there'd be land up on Hackney Wick that was being offered in exchange. But toxicologists, for instance, would go out there and say that that land was polluted and it wasn't the same as, it wasn't as good as verges that were covered in daffodils that looked beautiful along the existing road that were going to be taken away. That was, as I remember it, that was what the issue was about. I mean, obviously the issues were much, much broader as well, but in actual fact, the public inquiries that made it possible to compulsory purchase the houses that were going to be knocked down, that had all happened years beforehand. That was already decided. And this was just the final public inquiry about the exchange land.
And given that you was in that area for so long, can you remember when the first anti-road protesters arrived?
The people from outside? Well, probably, I think, you see, the campaign that we started off against the last public inquiry did bring in people from outside who had an interest because they had fought similar public inquiries in their areas. And I remember Archway. So they came along. And then I think by the time... And then... I think it was probably a year later or maybe the tail end of that public inquiry. So I think word was sort of spreading. And then the people who came along, like the Dongas tribe and the people who moved into Claremont Road, well, some of them would already have been there, but all the extra people who came along, the sort of, you know, it was all more sort of a bit more hippie-ish, for want of a better way to explain it. You know, people who looked a bit more like that. Bit more ecologically minded, that whole area of, you know, that the campaign that's so famous, that I think happened well after the public inquiry. So I think we did our bit, and then personally I went, you know, I was a bit exhausted, and I think they sort of took over where we left off, really. So in the year after the public inquiry, I don't know quite how that dates it, sorry. Can't quite remember.
So you've mentioned...
There's a way I could try and work it out. Hang on, because I was, in terms of jobs, I know which job I had when I did, when I was involved in all of that. I think that put, I was working in Camberwell for a housing association when I was taking time off for the public inquiry. So I think it was 86. Yeah, I think it was 89. I think that public inquiry was 89.
So do you think it might have been that same year or...?
Well, I think it was probably 90 or 91 before other people came along. But I can't be completely sure.
You mentioned, like, the part you was playing in the No M11 Link Road campaign.
Yes.
And the people coming from Archway and various yes. places to give advice and support.
Yeah, I mean, they were sort of, they looked like, you know, they were people who would wear suits. You know, they were old people who were older than us and sort of suit-wearing middle-class people. Right. They weren't the people who came along later on who moved into the area and, you know, were the sort of more hippie-ish eco-warrior type people.
Were there any Acme people coming from Archway? Because
no,
Acme had houses
no.
up.
Well, not that I know of. I mean, there might have been one that I didn't clock, but not as a known thing. No, it wasn't. They weren't people from there, I don't think. I'm pretty sure.
I do remember going to Pete's house around yeah. 1990 and Pete talking about some gypsies who had moved in on a little area of wasteland at the end of Dyer's Hall.
Yeah, Road. The middle of Dyer's Hall Road where they widened the railway bridge. Yeah, I remember that happening. That was when I was still living. I think it was, in fact, I think it was a bit earlier than that. I think it was 88. because I think I was still living at 103 Dyers Hall Road then, because these people moved in and they weren't the eco-warrior. They weren't the Colville-Claremont Road later stage. They were some travellers who moved in, and they moved into that bit of wasteland where originally there would have been terraced houses. You know, there was the railway bridge crossing over Dyers Hall Road, there was the bit of wasteland, and then there was our house, 103. And originally there would have been more houses along there, and probably in the Second World War that there was a bomb drop there or something like that. And so they moved in with their caravans, and they were there and they were fine, and they did a bit of drumming in the evenings and played a bit of music, but it was fine, didn't really disturb anybody. And then I think, well, I might be wrong about this, exactly how it happened, but the way I remember it is that one of the first bits of work that got done to make way for the road was widening that railway bridge. And at that point, or when it was coming up to that point, I think the police came along and wanted to move those people out of that bit of land. And they told us about it. And they said that what the police had said to them was, we can get you on drugs, and if we can't find any, we'll put them here, we'll plant them on you. So that was what was reported to us.
By the police?
The police threatened to plant drugs on them to get them out. They said, we can get you out, we can arrest you for drugs, and even if you don't have any, we can plant them on you.
And basically they left.
Oh, they left. They weren't, you know, they were, I think they were peace-loving hippies who didn't want to be persecuted, or, you know, they didn't want any hassle, basically. They were, yeah, so that was one summer, probably around 88.
So you must have some memory of the anti-road protesters arriving. At what point did they arrive, and how did that change? How did things change?
Well, I think after the public inquiry, when I was a bit drained and, you know, put an awful lot into all of that and everything that had gone on beforehand and all the fundraising and meetings. So I was sort of like a bit exhausted, and I think Pete felt the same way. So we sort of hung back. We just got on with our life. And I think so then other people moved into the area, and there was a big squatting movement, you know, making sure that any house that was left empty got occupied by somebody. And I remember Steve Rushton was involved in that, and someone called Christine and Clodagh, who were friends of his. And there were lots of people involved in making sure that any and every house was occupied so that they couldn't be knocked down. And I sort of remember that going on, and the area changed visually, because things happened, like all the outsides of the houses on Claremont Road were painted and stuff like that. Things like that began to happen. So you could see that from the tube. If you were on the central line from Leytonstone, you could see all of that happening. And I'd be sitting there looking out the windows, noticing it and thinking, whoa, that looks interesting, doesn't it? Or, you know, looking at all the graffiti and stuff and quite interested in it. And you'd be sitting there and there'd be slightly more straight-laced people sort of commenting on how dreadful it was, you know, to have all this graffiti. So that, and I vaguely remember that at the top of Philibrook Road there was a camp of people, and I was aware of things happening, like, you know, the trees being occupied up on Wanstead, up on the green in Wanstead, and then eventually, once we got to the stage where me and Pete were living in the house on Grove Green Road, opposite the Northcote, almost opposite the Northcote, which was when Claremont Road was sort of in its full swing of, you know, occupation and campaign and parties and stuff. I remember, you know, again, you'd hear lots of music in the evenings, you know, it was quite, and I quite liked that. That was nice to know that all of that was going on there, that the road was sort of alive and buzzing and all of that. But it all did feel even more temporary. And then the structure went up on the end of Claremont Road, and I remember that, and I remember police you know, one night when there was, I think they were trying to have, this is getting a bit later now, but when there was a big push to get people out, and there were masses of people there. And I remember coming up to, this is a bit of a traumatic story actually, but there was, it was evening, I was coming up the road, Pete was away in Hull teaching, I needed to get into the house. Actually, I wasn't living in that house then, I was still living on the other side of Grove Green Road, but I needed to get into Pete's house, which was, you know, which was where my studio was as well, but I was living in another house. Needed to get into Pete's house in order to feed the cats, because we had two cats and Pete was away in Hull. So routinely I would come home from work or wherever I'd been out, walk up the road, feed the cats, and then go to my house when Pete was away. That was the routine. Yeah, pick up the post while I was in Pete's house, that kind of thing. Maybe make a cup of tea, you know. So I came up the road and, of course, there were people everywhere. There was barricades up. There was an exclusion zone. So I wasn't being allowed through, basically. And and there were so many people there and it was dark. And I found a policeman on the other side of the barrier and explained that I needed to get into my boyfriend's house because he was away and I had to feed the cats. And that was what I always did. And I lived just up there. And could I go through, please? And he looked at me, didn't trust me an inch. He went off, had a word with somebody, and he came, and I knew I'd spoken the truth. So he came back to me and said, I've had a word with the people in that house. They said the cats are fine, so you don't need to worry about it. At which point I just felt, you know, when you're being completely lied to or fobbed off, it's quite devastating. So I sort of, you know, internally I collapsed because I knew I'd spoken the truth and I knew I was being lied to or manipulated or pushed away. So I, luckily I'm not the kind of person who screams and shouts. It sort of all happened internally, but I sort of, that was really quite a devastating experience. So I sort of gathered my strength inside and felt the steel in my soul and protested and said, well, if there are people in my boyfriend's house, that's terrible because there's nobody else that lives there. Nobody else should be in that house. And, you know, asked to go in again and really made my point as firmly as I could. And then possibly it was a different policeman by this time, but he went away and spoke to someone else and came back and said, OK, we'll take you into your to the house, but someone's got to come with you. And if there's any funny business, well, I don't know what he said. I don't know if he said we'll arrest you or whatever. But, you know, he was basically warning me because they didn't want anyone getting through to Claremont Road from, you know, Pete's house, which backed onto Claremont Road. So I went up with this policeman, turned the key in the lock. The policeman came in with me, which felt a bit weird because anything could have happened. And I fed the cats, picked up the post, did what I normally did. The policeman picked up a leaflet that was on the table and said something about it. There was some information about the road campaign that had come through and he just looked at that and commented on that. And then I said, right, finish now. That's all I needed to do, and went out and locked the door behind me. But it felt really, you know, to have been lied to that way was really quite devastating. But I think under those circumstances, you have to realise that actually the Crown or the representatives of the Crown or the state or whatever will not play fair when it's that sort of thing. And, you know, as Graham Miller said in his talk about the Linked Project, when he was describing worse things happening in his case because he had a small child in the house and their house was raided and his child has autism, you know, that was more traumatic than what happened to me in that instance. But, you know, that realisation that the state will take charge and will do what they want to do if they feel, if it is deemed that that's, you know, and that you can't, nobody plays fair in those situations. And at least we're in a country, you know, we're not in a country where people tend to, you know, there are countries where it's far worse. So it was devastating, but it could have been a lot worse, really. Yeah.
So,
awful. And then the area changed when they started knocking houses down. You suddenly saw, you know, saw views that you'd never seen before. It's kind of like, oh, a row of houses has gone and suddenly you can see the church spire up in Leytonstone, church tower up in Leytonstone. That sort of thing. the whole environment changing. Very weird. Very weird.
So how would you, say, describe that period around 92, 94?
Kind of. Well, I think by that time I was sort of getting on with my life and aware of all the... It's sort of like the protest was in other hands somehow. And of course I supported the protest, but I wasn't very active. I was just sort of getting on with life, really. Maybe I've got my timing wrong, because we only moved out of Grove Green Road in 97, or possibly 96. Yeah, there was... I suppose I was still painting away, and it was quite a productive time painting. I think I sort of was away from the work that I described earlier, which was doing pieces of work that were in layers and were very much about, you know, development and layers of one thing on top of another and maps and representations of the landscape. And I suppose I was into that stage of looking at stones and shells and things at that stage. Maybe I'd turned inwards a little bit.
That was the time as well where you found out you was diabetic.
Yeah, I think it probably was. That might have been a couple of years earlier, actually.
When you was involved in the No M11 campaign, did they organise any marches or anything? You mentioned...
The protest up in Leytonstone.
Yeah.
I don't remember marches. I remember things like knocking on doors, getting petitions signed, talking to people, jumble sales, parties, concerts, meetings, lots of talking, planning strategy, getting in touch with other anti-road campaigns. And, oh, there were organisations like Transport for London. There were you know, campaigning organisations that we got in touch with, going to their meetings occasionally, writing letters, that kind of stuff.
Was you around when any of the evictions took place?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I remember one. I mentioned earlier that Sandra Smith on Colville Road was a particularly good friend, and she was being evicted from her Acme house, or being moved out from her Acme house. And it was the time when, you know, there were protests every time there was a house that was going to be handed back, and that the emphasis was to try and get somebody into every property so that a property couldn't be empty, so that it couldn't be handed back to the Department of Transport. And so weirdly, you know, one morning I went along to support Sandra, because she lived on her own in this house and she was being moved out, which meant that she had to hand the keys back to Acme so that they could hand the house over to the Department of Transport. And I went along to sort of have breakfast with her and be there when this process happened, because it, you know, it's a bit horrible, really. So I was there with Sandra in her house, and the two Acme people came along. And then there was the people protesting outside. So it was kind of weird, because I was sort of, I wouldn't have wanted to hand the house back. But I was there because my friend had to move out, and I was supporting her, and there was the people outside campaigning against the house being handed back. And then the two Acme people inside, probably waiting for the Department of Transport person to come along or something like that, so that it could all be done. Yeah, I remember that one particularly, actually.
So who were the campaigners outside? Were they local people? And
I think people who lived up and down the roads, you know.
Were there any Acme artists outside?
Oh, yeah. There might have been Steve Rushton, you see. He was one of the people who was involved in that. I can't remember exactly. I don't think there were many Acme artists who got involved in that. I think it tended to be other people. And I can't remember exactly who, actually. I've got a feeling it wasn't so much Acme people who did that. I think, I just remember Steve because I knew him, but I think that was a sort of a minority. I think most Acme artists didn't do that, actually. They were probably a bit more, more concerned with their own practice and things than being involved in campaigns. But not, I don't mean that as a blanket, but I think a lot of ACME artists didn't do things like that so much.
And do you remember any of the evictions that local people experienced?
Not firsthand. I certainly didn't. Well, I don't. I mean, I remember. No, not. I don't remember in detail. I mean, I know that there were times where I'd be walking along the road or I'd know something was going along, so I'd go and stand outside somebody's house or whatever for a while. But Or you'd meet a bunch of people somewhere. You know, I'd know... At the time, I would know what was going on. But it's a bit vague in my mind, to be honest. You know, maybe my mind blanked it out a bit, because it is quite a big thing for, you know, it was a, you know, that sort of fragility really of things. It was a bit disturbing, I think. I haven't got many concrete memories, sorry.
I suppose, you know, on that note really, there is a kind of difference in experience, I think, to say the experience of the artists in that situation.
Yeah.
The more long-term residents.
Yeah, they were the people who were more, less able to possibly move on and adapt.
Yeah.
Because of age and history and things like that. Whereas the artists were there because it was short-term housing. You know, by the time the artists moved in, you know, we moved in because it was all scheduled for demolition. You know, it was a bonus for us. But, yeah, for other people who hadn't taken compulsory purchase for whatever reason because they didn't want to lose their house, you know, that's a lot more traumatic, really, I think.
Mm.
People like Richard Layton and his mother and Dolly and, you know, the other people around like that.
But even so, it was traumatic for you because you had lived there for
12 years in the end. 12 years, yeah, exactly. And you put down roots, don't you? And you make, you know, we made a particularly vibrant community, I think. And, or not, you know, I mean, someone like Grayson Perry, who lived on Dyers Hall Road, who I never knew personally, but every day I would walk past his house on the other side of the road and I would always look up and notice his pots in the front of the house. And it was, you know, that was part of, you know, it was unusual, and I was aware there was an artist there doing something quite visibly. He'd be sitting there sort of working away on his pots, and I'd be aware of, you know, and I love things like that, those unusual details of the community that we all had. So there were lots of people that I didn't know, but they were still part of the whole fabric of it, and that was interesting. And yeah,
I mean, what do you feel? I know it's a very complex question and you can't generalise, but in such a short period of time, there were these changing communities.
Mm.
I'm just wondering how they kind of rubbed together and mingled and.
Yeah. Well, I know that some people, Sally and Paul, Kitty Reeford probably did blend a bit with some of the new protesters that came in. There's someone I know at the moment who I know, Claire Hilder, who was never an artist along Claremont Road, but she lived along Claremont Road at the point where all of this was going along, and she was involved with, you know, she lived in that community. Christine Chittuck was an ACME artist who got involved on Claremont Road. Amit Ben-Zvi, actually, and her partner, whose name I've forgotten, but they got involved in creating the art house on Claremont Road, you know, and someone else called Lisa, I've forgotten her second name, she would have been an ACME tenant probably as well. I'm not sure if Amit was, but she was probably squatting, but she was an artist, you know. So there were artists who got involved in contributing to the art house on Claremont Road, or even set it up. I'm not sure exactly who set it up, but, you know, there were people from the art community, you know, that who exhibited in the Leighton Artist Group studios, such as Amit and Christine and this Lisa person that I'm half remembering, and someone called Donald, probably. I can't remember. Anyway, there were people who were Leighton Artist Group members who were quite heavily involved in things on Claremont Road more than I was. I was sort of, I remember going along there once and being quite interested in it and thinking, oh, I could do trees and stuff on the walls here. But I mean, I didn't do that. I was, I don't know, busy doing other things or a bit kind of jaded from the experiences that I'd had as well, actually. Or I felt I'd done my bit and it was other people's turn and I just wanted to get on with, you know, doing what I wanted to do in the evenings and the weekends and on my days off, you know, selfish as that might sound. But yes, I think the communities did blend a little bit.
Mm.
Yeah.
And when you look back on that whole period of time, I mean, for you it's 12 years, when all those artists were living together in that area on such a big scale, do you think that time could ever be repeated?
No, I think it's unique to the circumstances of here, you know, those, that particular pattern of roads, like, you know, Claremont Road was able to be what it was partly because it was a quiet road, similarly with Colville Road, you know, the community spirit that was there, and you know, the fact that there was the Northcote pub on the corner that everybody could get to very easily, and that that was such a meeting place for so many years, for so many, not everybody, but for a lot of people who lived up and down the roads. And, you know, that was a, you know, it's particular to this, that particular place, I think. And that we were all living in northeast London, probably because it was cheap, but also because it was London, you know, artists kind of, maybe not so much now, but then people wanted to be in London because of proximity to galleries and cultural things. And obviously that's not necessarily the same now. You know, there's a lot more going on in different areas, and we have the internet now and things like that for people to promote themselves and communicate and share ideas and sell work even. You know, that probably wasn't, that was probably in its infancy at the end of that period. And also working, having studios in domestic houses, well, that's not new, but that sort of, you know, using these small terraced houses for making art in, that makes it very particular, you know, the sort of the structure of those houses and the fabric of them and the way that people adapted their houses and knocked down walls and, you know, the, that particular flavour is particular to these sorts of houses, I think. And that it was, you know, the 80s and early 90s rather than a different generation of time, because, you know, there was still, in the 80s, I always think there was very much a mainstream culture and an alternative culture, and there was that sort of flavour to things, you know, you were, to everything, actually, I think, at that time.
So do you think there were more possibilities in some ways?
Well, you see, one thing that I think happened, I think the cheap housing and studio space and community and all of that gave, you know, I definitely had the experience of being able to develop in many ways, you know, artistically, personally, because I could survive on working part-time, so that gives you space and time. So it's a bit like, well, it's quite an opportunity, I think. Sorry, what was the question?
Yeah, I just wondered if in some ways there was more possibilities.
Well, in London, I think it would be difficult to have that space and time now for, you know, young people, youngish people who want to do their own thing and not be tied to having to work full time. And I think to be creative, to be able to be creative, and you do need support, you do need to be able to have time, you do need to be able to focus. So it gave that, definitely, you know, to me and a lot of other people who wouldn't have been able to focus on their work so much, you know. And I think another thing that happened, one thing that, you know, the experience of, I remember through in the 90s, Pete's experience, Pete Owen's experience with City Racing Gallery, which ran from 89 to 99 or 98, 98 actually, I think. And, you know, he was living here and ran that exhibition at the Art East Gallery and then took that and other ideas and started up City Racing Gallery down at the Oval along with other friends. Part of what happened during the 90s with that was, you know, I remember seeing the idea of difference between mainstream and alternative changing, because in the beginning I would have thought that my perception would have been that it was alternative, but then this idea began to take root that actually galleries like City Racing and other sorts of projects were more like a seedbed for the more established commercial galleries. So there was this idea of connection rather than things being separate. And I think that took root as we got into the 90s, really. I think that was a change that happened. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, for instance, the City Racing Gallery has had a little bit of support from Carsten Schubert Gallery. They ran a fundraiser for City Racing Gallery one evening and sold tickets. And that was the point where they described City Racing as being kind of like a seedbed for them. And that was the point where I really saw that. Yeah.